KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
The U.S. and France always stand on the same side, the right side, I would say, of history. And this is exactly what's at stake today.
In the Oval Office, it wasn't clear that the leaders of the U.S. and France are on the same side today.
For Monday, February 24th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Coming up, the president has chosen a right-wing podcast host to be the second in command at the FBI.
The appointment of Dan Bongino has pushed things over the edge, and there is a crisis at the FBI.
Also, Miami is telling spring breakers who want to go wild that the party might end up in handcuffs.
The whole idea is you come down here to our city, you play by our rules, not break the law, and we'll welcome you back again and again and again.
Plus, it's the third anniversary of Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
And reaction from Rome on the Pope's hospitalization.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. The Trump administration is backing down from requiring federal workers to respond to an email asking them to list five things they accomplished last week. NPR Shannon Bond reports some agency officials had pushed back against the email directive announced by Elon Musk.
The government-wide email sent on Saturday gave federal workers until Monday night to send their lists. But as that deadline loomed, some agencies, including the Departments of Defense, State, and Energy, told staff not to respond. Other departments gave conflicting guidance, leaving employees confused about whether and how to comply. Late Monday afternoon, the Office of Personnel Management, which sent the email, told agencies that responses are voluntary and that not responding would not be considered a resignation. That contradicts claims by President Trump and his advisor Elon Musk that federal workers who do not reply to the email are at risk of losing their jobs. Shannon Bond, NPR News.
Speaking at the White House, besides President Trump, French President Emmanuel Macron said the two leaders agreed on European peacekeepers on the ground in Ukraine, backed up by a U.S. security guarantee. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports Europeans say the talks went better than expected and feel Macron may have succeeded in injecting a dose of reality into Trump's view of the Russian president and his war.
The press conference was broadcast live on French television. This peace cannot mean the surrender of Ukraine, and it can't be a ceasefire without guarantees, said Macron. Trump said he was sure President Putin wants a peace deal, too. That wasn't the case in 2014, said Macron, switching to English.
President Putin violated this peace.
Or in 2022, when he spent 7 hours with Putin just 2 weeks before his invasion.
He denied everything, but we didn't have security guarantees.
This time we'll have security guarantees, said Macron, and if Putin breaks them, he'll be going against all of us. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
The Trump administration is developing plans to build immigration detention facilities on U.S. military bases around the country. NPR's Joel Rose reports it would significantly expand the military's role in immigration enforcement.
The Department of Homeland Security is asking the Defense Department for help detaining immigrants without legal status. That request is laid out in a memo from DHS that was obtained by NPR. The plan would begin with a deportation hub at Fort Bliss near El Paso that could eventually hold as many as 10,000 immigrants and could serve as a model for as many as 10 other holding facilities on bases in New Jersey, Florida, Utah, Wyoming, and elsewhere. The request is still in the planning stages, according to a DOD official who was not authorized to speak publicly. But if activated, it could dramatically expand detention capacity to support President Trump's push for mass deportations. Joel Rose, NPR News, Washington.
Mixed close on Wall Street. The Dow was up 33 points. The Nasdaq fell 237 points today. You're listening to NPR. Provisional results seem to be confirming that mainstream conservatives led by Friedrich Merz won Germany's national election, while a far-right party has surged to become the country's second largest. The outcome ensures Ukraine will have strong support from the European Union's second-largest country. Germans also will be looking for renewal for a badly battered economy. The campaign, much like in the U.S., also dealt with issues of immigration and comes amid uncertainty over future U.S.-EU relations. This week marks the 50th anniversary of a landmark meeting in biology when scientists gathered to discuss the potential dangers of mixing DNA from different sources. NPR's Noel Greenfield Boyce reports hundreds of researchers have gathered at the same spot in California.
Back when the tools for combining DNA from different life forms were brand new, concerns about unintended consequences led scientists to call for an unusual moratorium. In February of 1975, they gathered in a conference center at Asilomar State Beach in California and hammered out safeguards to let lab work with recombinant DNA go forward. The anniversary is being observed this week by researchers, historians, and others who are meeting at the same place. They're pondering the future of genetic engineering and the risks posed by advances like synthetic cells and artificial intelligence. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
Crude oil futures prices gained ground amid ongoing uncertainty over the fate of a Russia-Ukraine peace deal and how that could affect supply. Oil was up 30 cents a barrel today to settle at $70.70 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Capital One with the Capital One Saver Card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at MacFound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington. It is the third anniversary of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And President Trump and French President Emmanuel Macron met at the White House today to talk about their views on ending that war. Trump emphasized that the United States has done more than Europe to back Ukraine. Macron took issue with some of the assertions, but said Europe is ready to do more to ensure peace on the continent. NPR senior national political correspondent Mara Liasson is at the White House. Hi, Mara.
Hi there.
What more did we learn today about what the U.S. and its Western allies want to do to end this war?
Well, we certainly learned a lot about what the Western allies or erstwhile allies want to do to end the war. Emmanuel Macron kind of laid out his vision for how a peace between Ukraine and Russia would be verified and guaranteed. He said that there would have to be an American aspect of that. This is something that Trump has never talked about. But Macron really laid it out as an existential challenge to Europe. He said, we don't want to live in a world where it's the law of the strongest, where international borders can be violated by anyone. Here's some of what he said, speaking through an interpreter.
The fact that there are Europeans that are ready to engage to provide for these security guarantees. And now there's a clear American message that the U.S., as an ally, is ready to provide that solidarity for that approach. That's a turning point, in my view.
That sounds like a very optimistic
That's
characterization.
Very, very optimistic. He seemed to say that the Americans have this feeling, but
did Trump
we
say
didn't
that?
Hear that from Trump, not at all. As a matter of fact, Trump did say that he, when he was asked, why could you trust Russia? He says, I really believe that Russia is ready to make a deal. And one of the most definitive things we heard from Trump was this.
My administration is making a decisive break with the foreign policy failures of the past administration and, frankly, the past. I ran against a very foolish foreign policy establishment, and their recklessness has led to the death of many, many people. Under our administration, we're forging a new path that promotes peace around the world.
Well, he certainly is forging a new path, and this on a day when the United States voted with North Korea, Iran, and Russia at the United Nations against a resolution that would have condemned Russia's invasion of Ukraine 3 years ago. He was asked in the Oval Office meeting with Macron whether he would call Vladimir Putin a dictator, since he had just called Zelensky a dictator. He said he refused to say that, and he said, I don't use those words lightly.
You know, in the past, Trump and Macron have had a warm relationship. Now, as the divide between the U.S. and Western Europe seems to be growing, was that warmth on display at all?
It certainly was, but I don't know if it means anything. They talked about it a lot. They joked. They congratulated each other about the restoration of Notre Dame. They joked about how beautiful the French language was. They held hands in the Oval Office. But if Donald Trump it has correctly described his foreign policy as a break with the past, which means a break with NATO, a kind of return to three giant powerful countries, Russia, China, and the U.S., have spheres of influence, and they don't really care about allies, then that personal chummy-chummy relationship really doesn't mean much. So a lot of this is TBD. What exactly will be the contents of any kind of a ceasefire and peace agreement that the U.S. negotiates with Russia for Ukraine? And how much is the U.S. willing to put on the line to maintain that agreement? We don't know the answers to that yet.
That is NPR's Mara Liasson at the White House. Thank you, Mara.
Thank you.
Okay, we turn now to news out of the FBI. President Trump has named right-wing podcast host Dan Bongino as the FBI's deputy director. That means Bongino will be the number two official at the Bureau behind the recently confirmed director, Trump loyalist Kash Patel. NPR Justice correspondent Ryan Lucas is covering the story and joins us now. Hi, Ryan.
Hi there.
Okay, let's start with who Dan Bongino is exactly. Like, he's a big name in conservative media, but beyond his podcast, tell us more about him.
So first off, President Trump announced this pick in a post on social media, calling it great news for law enforcement and for American justice. Now, as for Bongino, he worked as a cop in New York City for a few years in the late 1990s, and then as a Secret Service agent for more than a decade, in fact, in the 2000s, working on presidential protective details, for example, during the George W. Bush administration. But he's best known for what he's done since leaving law enforcement, because over the past decade, really, he's become a very well-known right-wing pundit. He hosted a Fox News program for a few years. But his podcast, The Dan Bongino Show, is now one of the most popular podcasts in the country. And he's used it to push baseless claims about the 2020 election being stolen, about the FBI itself. Bongino was banned from YouTube for pushing COVID-19 misinformation. He's also a fierce political partisan. And to give you an example of that, here he is speaking in 2018.
We win, you lose, the new rules are in effect. My life is all about owning the libs now.
Okay, well, now he's been tapped as the deputy director of the FBI. Is it unusual, Ryan, to have someone like him in that particular job?
It's basically unheard of to have someone like Bongino for this role. Traditionally, a senior FBI agent serves as the deputy director, and that makes a lot of sense because they would have experience in the Bureau, know the ins and outs of the organization. Remember, there are around 38,000 people who work there. The Bureau has massive responsibilities. We're talking things like counterterrorism, violent crime, national security. And the deputy director, in essence, runs the day-to-day operations of the FBI. Now, the FBI Agents Association actually sent its members a message yesterday that the new director, Kash Patel, had told them back in January that the deputy director should be an active special agent. But after Bongino was announced as the deputy, Patel raved about it in a post on X, called Bongino an ideal choice. So the situation now is the director and the deputy director are two close allies of Trump, two men who have a long history of making very partisan political statements. They have no senior law enforcement experience. And these are the two gentlemen now running the FBI.
And this is all on top of the turmoil that's been happening at the FBI in recent weeks, right? Like, how do these leadership changes play into that, you think?
Well, you're right. It's definitely a turbulent time at the Bureau. The Trump Justice Department forced out at least eight senior FBI officials, folks who would have been providing guidance to the new director. That shakeup was followed by the Justice Department demanding and receiving the names of all FBI personnel who worked Capitol riot cases. That touched off fears about possible mass firings. Here's Chris O'Leary. He's a former senior FBI official who retired in the last few years.
I would absolutely say the appointment of Dan Bongino has pushed things over the edge, and there is a crisis at the FBI. People are concerned that we are seeing the intentional dismantlement of the FBI.
Now, I've heard similar concerns from other current and former FBI officials. Patel, for his part, has talked about ending what he claims is a politicization of the FBI. But one former senior FBI official told me that putting Bongino in as deputy instead of a career agent is the definition of politicizing the Bureau.
Okay, well then what does all of this mean for the FBI's work?
Well, that's a big question. What impact it will have on the work, on the priorities. Patel said he wants to get back to the basics of fighting crime, but there are a lot of concerns that this new leadership could use the vast powers of the FBI to go after Trump's perceived enemies, as Trump himself has talked about.
That is NPR's Ryan Lucas. Thank you so much, Ryan.
Thank you.
The Vatican has announced the start of nighttime prayers for Pope Francis, who remains in critical condition in the hospital. The 88-year-old is battling double pneumonia, and over the weekend he was also diagnosed with early kidney failure. NPR's Ruth Sherlock reports from the hospital in Rome where he's being treated.
This is a smart, busy hospital with gleaming, clean corridors. On a hillside overlooking the hospital, there are lines of TV cameras. In the lobby, you hear snatches of conversation, and a lot of it is about Pope Francis.
Francesco Padovano and Luigi Antonelli are physiotherapy students here in Gemelli Hospital. Antonelli tells me they went up to the 10th floor where Pope Francis is being treated. It's a VIP area with parquet floors and gold pommels, they say. Security services stopped them in the corridor.
I servizi interni vi bloccano al corridoio massimo.
Antonelli and Padovano are young, just 20 and 19 years old. It's exciting to have the Pope here, but then they strike a more serious note.
No, la differenza dei messaggi politici, secondo me, che lui si fa molto più vicino al popolo.
Padovano says the difference between the Pope and politicians is that his messaging brings him closer to people.
Sì, la persona più vicina a noi, secondo me.
Yes, he's much closer to us, adds Antonelli. The Vatican has announced the start of nightly prayers for Pope Francis in St. Peter's Square. In countries around the world, churches have been holding special services. At the Basilica of St. John Lateran, the oldest public church in Rome, with gold leaf ceilings and towering statues of the 12 disciples, hundreds have gathered to pray. These are difficult moments for the Holy Father and also for humanity, for the whole world, says Marissa Meron, a thin woman who looks in her 60s.
Perché è un momento terribile, credo.
It's a terrible moment in the world, she repeats. Pope Francis has been outspoken about civilian suffering in the wars in Gaza between Israel and Hamas and in Ukraine. And in a message from hospital prepared for a mass he would usually lead in person, he called on people to remember the victims of armed conflicts.
So even from his hospital room, he was calling for peace.
Sister Mary Johnson was among the congregation in the cathedral.
We are very grateful. We're here for this liturgy to ask God's strength and healing for Pope Francis.
It was a moment of unity for a pope, she says, who means so much, not just to the church, but also the world. Ruth Sherlock, NPR News, Rome.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Dignity Memorial, helping families today to protect their loved ones tomorrow. Planning celebrations of life in advance can give families peace of mind. Learn more at dignitymemorial.com. And from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Elsa Chang. For decades, Western countries, including the U.S., imposed layer after layer of crippling sanctions on Syria to punish its dictatorial regime. That regime fell in December, and the European Union has now suspended some sanctions. And many sanctions, though, are still ongoing, and Syrians say they need them lifted to rebuild their country. NPR's Emily Fang and Jawad Rizallah report.
Very little of Syria's basic infrastructure works anymore. Its hospitals are nearly empty of equipment. Entire neighborhoods have been obliterated and left unfixed. And most of its power grid is still offline. Engineer Ibrahim Hamaju shows us around one of Syria's few remaining power distribution sites.
This transformer is older than me, but it's old.
The transformer is corroded and cocooned by cinder blocks to shield it from artillery strikes. All this care because it's literally irreplaceable due to U.S. sanctions. Some of those sanctions started in the 1970s. The majority came after the 2000s, however, cutting off banking and most trade to punish Syria's former regime for abetting Islamist extremists. And then, in response to human rights atrocities during the civil war, so tight were sanctions on Syria that after 2019, any person found helping Syrians evade U.S. sanctions would also be sanctioned themselves.
It's just a black market happening, right?
This is Damascus resident Tarek Rawanji. He owns a supermarket and also teaches high school economics. One of the big topics he teaches is the impact of sanctions.
So when we open the book and we read about sanctions, I tell them, you are living the book right now, you know, because they can see all the sanctions.
For example, Syria has ample natural resources like cotton and petroleum. But Rawanji points out it's hard to trade that internationally. And for him to even buy foreign goods for his supermarket, because Syria has no foreign exchange reserves after decades of sanctions. He echoes what nearly all Syrians feel, that sanctions punished an old regime they hated too. But that regime is now gone, and now Rawanji wants sanctions lifted.
Then we can get, you know, our country built again, you know, without the help of the support, financial support of any country.
Syria's interim government told NPR it wants to entice some 6 million of its citizens who fled abroad during the civil war to come back. But to do that, its new electricity minister, Omar Shakrouk, says they need to prove to them that the country will rebuild their homes and offer basic services, like electricity. He says financing is the biggest obstacle. He can now speak with foreign companies who are interested in building a new power grid for Syria, but they're not allowed to invest. No bank is allowed to process their transactions into Syria. One of the projects Shakrouk would like to fix is this thermal plant in northern Syria. It was built in 1979. At the time, an impressive engineering feat. The plant's director, Mohammed Al-Mohammed, shows me how sanctions have hampered every part of the hulking plant. The huge fan engines that once sucked in oxygen-rich air to feed the furnaces, now they're rusted beyond repair. The cooling water pumps are also offline. Their mechanical innards have been painstakingly taken apart by engineer Mazen Al-Awad in a last-ditch effort to fix them, only to discover he had no more spare parts. He says he has not gotten any replacement parts since 2009 because of sanctions. Al-Mohammed, the plant director, spent most of the last three decades bootstrapping workarounds to keep the plant going. But finally, last October, the last turbine stopped working. and the plant creaked to a complete halt. He says he feels utterly depressed. We feel like we're dying of frustration, he says. He spent his entire career staving off what should have been the plant's preventable closure. European and American lawmakers say Syria's new government first needs to prove it's committed to turning the page on the old regime's practices before they lift sanctions. Syrians argue they need sanctions lifted first to rebuild and thus prove they can change. Emily Fang, NPR News, Idlib, Syria.
Spring breakers headed to Miami Beach this year will encounter a long list of strict regulations. It's part of the city's effort to crack down on spring break crowds. Julia Cooper from member station WLRN reports.
Miami Beach, here we come!
The city released a slick ad that follows a fictional group of college students excited to indulge in Miami Beach revelry in a spoofed reality TV show.
Once we got to Miami Beach, things went downhill fast.
They have a good time. Until city regulations get in the way.
You're drinking in public, that's not allowed. The speaker, that's not allowed.
Rule after rule after rule.
The message, while the show is fake, the penalties for not complying with city laws are not. The $425,000 video is part of a larger crackdown that follows a spate of shootings in recent years, including two that were fatal in 2023.
We saw that the measures we took last year were necessary, and it worked. We had an incredibly successful spring break. No fatalities, no shootings, no stampedes.
That's Miami Beach Mayor Stephen Miner. He says that while the long-term goal is to eventually be able to loosen restrictions, there aren't plans for when that might happen.
We felt it necessary to do it again this year, and we'll take every year on a case-by-case basis. It partly depends on how successful we are this year.
Throughout March, there will be $100 parking fees, sobriety checkpoints, curfews, and limited sidewalk seating, among a long list of other restrictions. Though officials consider last year's spring break wildly successful, Miami Beach Police Chief Wayne Jones says he understands the rules had some negative impacts.
The way I look at it, quite frankly, is short-term pain for long-term gain.
Last year, some residents complained about more traffic congestion as people looked for parking, and businesses along Ocean Drive say they lost some customers. But Jones says the city's goal is clear.
Get to a place where kids are coming down, you're having a good time without shooting, hurting each other. We're going to have to go through this process.
Some critics say the strict regulations racially target Black visitors who've been coming to South Beach over the last two decades. But Chief Jones says that's not the case.
We police behavior, not race or ethnicity. And the whole idea is you come down here to our city, you play by our rules, not break the law, and we'll welcome you back again and again and again.
Crackdowns like this have worked at other popular Florida destinations. Stacy Ritter heads Visit Lauderdale. She says in the 90s, when Fort Lauderdale increased restrictions on spring breakers,
we saw a definite dip. And those visitors went elsewhere, Panama City, Daytona Beach, which then saw their own issues as a result. And then they started to crack down. And so they sort of migrated back south.
Ritter says in this spring break moving cycle, Fort Lauderdale wouldn't mind taking in some of the crowds avoiding Miami this year.
I think if Miami Beach is trying to crack down on the spring break crowd completely, they're doing a good job of conveying the message that visitors aren't welcome and that they should go someplace else. We'll take advantage of that.
Should they choose Fort Lauderdale, she says the city will also have rules to abide by because it has learned how to manage crowds of students. Spring break restrictions on Miami Beach will be in effect the entire month of March. For NPR News, I'm Julia Cooper in Miami.
This is NPR News.
In a new memoir, Sonny Vaccaro details his legendary career in sports marketing, starting with the signing of Michael Jordan to Nike.
What I was able to do for the first and last time is say to the public, ladies and gentlemen, this is how it happened.
Legends and Souls, the memoir of an American original, on the next morning edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Coming up, the new video game Avowed, where choices are at the center of the story. What you decide drives the entire plot.
Video games are the new storytelling medium of our time.
We'll have more after this summary of the day's news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. European leaders are rallying around Ukraine's president as the country marks 3 years since Russia's full-scale invasion. Kyiv is unsure it can still depend on its U.S. allies. President Trump moves to build closer economic relations with Russia. Trump welcomed France's president to the White House this afternoon, where he held a news conference and talked about the possibility of ending the Russia-Ukraine war.
The purpose of our meeting today is to end another battle, a really horrible one, a war, something that we haven't seen since the Second World War, that is ravaging European soil, the deadliest and most destructive conflict that one can imagine. I've seen the pictures, I've seen the satellite photos and lots of other photos, and it's a horrible thing that's happening.
Trump's rush to end the war in Ukraine and establish new concessions with Russia is stoking fears that could undermine Kyiv and Europe's security. Some teachers are worried about incorporating Black history lessons as the Department of Education directs public schools to end diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. From Nebraska Public Media, Cassidy Arena has more.
Some school districts and teachers in Nebraska are hesitant to speak about Black History Month with the announcement that districts could lose federal funding if they don't eliminate diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives. Tim Royers is president of the Nebraska State Education Association.
There's such a profound chilling effect that's happened right now because of the orders coming out of Washington. I don't think any school or district wants to talk about it for fear that that's going to get weaponized and used against them to potentially take away federal funding.
The Education Department says it'll start checking on school compliance at the end of the month. For NPR News, I'm Cassidy Arena in Lincoln, Nebraska.
Stocks finished mixed on Wall Street today. This is NPR News. In Beirut, 5 months after he was killed, crowds continue to gather at the shrine of Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah. He was buried yesterday in a ceremony attended by hundreds of thousands of mourners. NPR's Jawad Rizkala has more.
Nasrallah's funeral was held in Beirut's biggest sports stadium before the coffin was transported to a shrine in Beirut's southern suburbs. Thousands of mourners gathered in the cold, thronging the newly built glass and marble shrine and weeping over the loss of a leader many considered a father figure. Mourners crowded into the shrine and tried to touch the coffin in a final chaotic farewell. Nasrallah, 64, was one of the founders of the Iran-backed militant group created to counter Israel's 1982 invasion of Lebanon. Nasrallah's successor, Hashem Safiyuddin, who was killed in an Israeli attack in October, was also buried on Monday. Jawad Rizkallah, NPR News, Beirut.
Beyond the Gates is the first network soap opera to premiere since 1999. It's also the first Black daytime soap opera in 35 years. The show made its debut on CBS today and centers around four generations of the Dupree family, set in an affluent gated community in Maryland. The show replaces The Talk that was canceled after 15 seasons. The new soap opera is a collaboration between CBS and the NAACP Ventures. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station And from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. The last few weeks have caused confusion and frustration for federal employees. But today, at least some workers may be getting more clarity on where they stand. A federal oversight agency recommends halting the Trump administration's firing of probationary employees. It could be a first step in pausing the mass purge that started almost 2 weeks ago. To help us understand exactly what is going on here and what could be next, we're joined now by NPR's Andrea Hsu. Hi, Andrea.
Hi, Elsa.
Okay, so first tell us about this decision, which is, it's like affecting federal employees who have been fired, right?
Yeah, this was a decision issued by the Office of Special Counsel, and that's the independent agency that's responsible for protecting federal employees from what's called prohibited personnel practices, basically illegal actions. Mm-hmm. So the other week when the mass firings of these probationary employees had gotten underway, attorneys in Washington, D.C. asked the Office of Special Counsel to look into them, and they highlighted six individuals working at six different agencies.
Okay, and what did the special counsel say?
Well, he looked into the cases of these six people, whether they had performance issues, what reason they were given for being fired, and he concluded that there was some evidence that the government had not followed the proper procedures for removing these people from their jobs.
Wait, so could those people get their jobs back?
Well, not immediately. The special counsel, though, has asked another federal agency, which is called the Merit Systems Protection Board, for a 45-day stay while his office continues to investigate these firings. And if the board doesn't respond within 3 days, the stay will take effect. That does mean those six people would go back to work, at least temporarily. And the special counsel is also considering ways to seek relief for more fired workers. And Elsa, I know this sounds complicated, but this is the system Congress set up to hear these cases involving federal workers. And there is also another twist here. The special counsel, his name is Hampton Dellinger, he was actually himself fired by Trump the other week and then reinstated by a federal judge, which is why we have this decision today.
So interesting. Okay, and then on top of all that, there have also been reports about this pretty strange email that federal employees got over the weekend asking them to report what they had accomplished last week. What's the latest with that email?
Yeah, there's still a ton of confusion over this email, over whether it's even a legal request. You'll remember Elon Musk first mentioned this email on X and suggested that employees could lose their jobs for not replying. But Musk himself certainly has no authority to order federal agencies what to do with their own employees. And it's doubtful whether even the Office of Personnel Management can do that. So we have seen some agencies push back. For example, the Departments of Defense and Homeland Security told their employees, don't respond, we'll respond for you if needed. But other agencies have encouraged their employees to respond. The Treasury Department, for example, told its employees, you are directed to respond, and said it was an effort to increase accountability. And this afternoon, we learned that the Office of Personnel Management actually told agencies that responses are voluntary and employees won't be at risk of losing their jobs if they don't respond.
Well, has President Trump weighed in on this what did you do last week email?
Yeah, well, today he called it an ingenious idea. You know, he complained about federal workers not showing up for work and suggested without evidence that there are people on the payroll who don't even exist. So he said this was a way for them to figure out who's actually working for the government. But also, since the weekend, I've heard from lots of federal workers who are just really offended by this email.
That is NPR's Andrea Hsu. Thank you so much, Andrea.
Thank you, Elsa.
Now, the fight over the future of the U.S. Department of Education. President Trump says he wants to close it. And soon the Senate is expected to vote to confirm Linda McMahon, his nominee for Education Secretary. At her confirmation hearing, McMahon said she'd work to realize Trump's vision of unwinding the department.
He pledged to make American education the best in the world, return education to the states where it belongs.
But at the same hearing, it was also clear Republicans are conflicted about the fate of the department. NPR's Corey Turner has more.
The Education Department has always been a popular target for Republicans, a morass of federal bureaucracy and a rallying cry for states' rights.
In many cases, our wounds are caused by the excessive consolidation of power in our federal education establishment.
During her hearing, Linda McMahon blamed the department for falling student achievement. But fellow Republican Lisa Murkowski of Alaska reminded everyone that the Education Department doesn't control schools. In fact, federal law makes it illegal for the department to tell them what or even how to teach.
Prohibiting any federal employee from mandating, directing, or controlling a state's school districts or school's instructional content.
So what does the Education Department do? Well, it's got two main jobs. It protects the civil rights of students, and it sends money to schools that need it most.
On average, only about 10% of public funds that go towards educating a child comes from the federal taxpayer.
That's Republican Bill Cassidy of Louisiana, and he's right. The nation's schools are funded almost entirely by states and local taxes, which is why a wealthier school system might spend $2,000 or $3,000 more per child than a less well-off school system just a few miles away. What the Education Department does is try to even the scales just a bit. So that 10% of funding that does come from the department, it goes to help the nation's most vulnerable kids in big cities and lots of tiny one-stop towns. And it helps pay for costly special education services, which is why even Republicans asked McMahon if that money would keep flowing.
Yes. It is not the president's goal to defund the programs. Is only to have it operate more efficiently.
So that's the money. The department also enforces federal civil rights laws like Title IX, banning sex-based discrimination, and IDEA, which guarantees an education to kids with disabilities. When McMahon suggested the management of IDEA could be moved to a different federal agency, Democrat Maggie Hassan of New Hampshire offered a history lesson.
Before IDEA, before the Department of Education existed, state and local schools did not educate these kids. They barred them from the classrooms. These kids were institutionalized and abused.
It wasn't clear how Republicans at the hearing felt about moving IDEA, though the first question McMahon got from a Republican was about how the department could do even more to help kids with disabilities, specifically dyslexia. Where Republicans seemed most angry with the department, accusing it of overreach, was with a Biden-era effort to expand Title IX protections for transgender students in K-12 and college.
Binding regulations that required our college campuses to put biological men into women's locker rooms.
Missouri Republican Josh Hawley excoriated the department for going too far. But then he told McMahon he hopes she'll push the department to do even more.
Will you enforce the law, Title VI to the hilt, and will you make sure that Jewish Americans are safe on our campuses, for heaven's sake?
To which McMahon replied,
absolutely, or face defunding of their monies.
Very good.
In fact, since the hearing, the Trump administration has added to the department's to-do list, warning all schools that receive federal money that it considers Biden-era efforts around diversity and equity to be themselves discriminatory. And schools have just 2 weeks to stop, or else they'll have to answer to the U.S. Department of Education. Corey Turner, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Black History Month is drawing to a close, and it's brought anxiety for some teachers because of the Trump administration's push to roll back diversity efforts. Nebraska Public Media's Cassidy Arena has more.
Over here we have Dr. Charles Drew. They love this area, love to pretend they're doctors.
Gwen Partridge, or Mrs. Gwen to her pre-K students, walks around her homemade Black History Museum at the YMCA Emanuel Early Learning Center in Omaha, Nebraska.
What's great is when they learn something about Black history, and then their parents come back and say, thank you.
Partridge has been a pre-K teacher for 20 years, and the Black History Museum she spearheaded for the school has exhibits for the students. There's a music section, a hair salon, and plenty of books about influential Black history makers. the students in her mostly white class ask her why she has brown skin and they don't. One of her lessons is about the first black student to attend an all-white school, Ruby Bridges.
I'm like, she was little, just like you guys, and just imagine how scared she was walking to in a classroom with nobody else the same color as her skin.
But it's a tense time for educators who teach black history. The U.S. Department of Education recently told public schools and universities to eliminate diversity initiatives or lose public funding. Tim Royers is president of the Nebraska State Education Association. He recently attended a national meeting with other teachers' union leaders.
There's such a profound chilling effect that's happened right now because of the orders coming out of Washington. I don't think any school or district wants to talk about it for fear that that's going to get weaponized and used against them to potentially take away federal funding.
Officials and teachers with three large districts in Nebraska declined to speak about Black history education this year. Royers, a former history teacher, says educators at the forefront of these discussions are exhausted, and these pressures contribute to low teacher retention. But not all teachers are experiencing these same tensions. Dan Wade III is a social science teacher in Oxnard, a city in Southern California. He co-wrote an African American studies course for his high school, which launched last year.
Me teaching this class, it almost feels like a way of standing up for Black history. I think essentially what I'm saying is it's caused me to kind of step up in a way that before I would have avoided.
But Wade says he isn't sure about the future of his class. LeGarrett King is professor of social studies education at the State University of New York at Buffalo, specializing in Black history and racial literacy.
You know, lately it's no one should be taught that any race is superior. That's not being taught in Black history. No one's teaching that Black people are superior to white people.
He says often it's Black educators leading the charge to teach more about Black history. But Black teachers are underrepresented in American schools.
Are we going to have fun tomorrow?
Back in Mrs. Gwen's pre-K class in Omaha, the kids cheer as she walks back into the classroom.
Black history, you know, that's something that we all should learn about, part of our history, because now not for sure. I'm reading different things that they might be taking, you know, Black history and Black study out of schools. So if we don't get it here, they might not get it.
She plans to retire in June, but she intends to, quote, pass the torch to make sure the Pre-K Black History Museum opens its doors every February. For NPR News, I'm Cassidy Arena in Omaha, Nebraska.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Today marks 3 years since Russia launched a full-scale war on Ukraine. More than a dozen world leaders are in Kyiv to show support for Ukraine. Meanwhile, the Trump administration is warming up to Russia and squeezing Ukraine for concessions. NPR's Joanna Kakissis reports from Kyiv.
Since the full-scale invasion, Ukrainians who have lost someone in this war have planted small flags in central Kyiv's Maidan Square. Today, thousands of blue and yellow national flags flutter in the chilly wind. Nearby, 27-year-old Valeria Antonenko mourns her own losses.
These have been the most difficult years of my life. I was forced out of my home and I lost my brother 8 months ago. He volunteered to fight.
He's among tens of thousands of Ukrainian soldiers killed in the last 3 years. And this weighs heavily on Antonenko whenever anyone asks her if she's willing to give up occupied land for peace.
If it is a concession of land, it will be my land, the land I came from and for which my brother died and my friends are fighting. It's such a difficult question for me.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is facing difficult questions of his own, including how to work with the Trump administration, which has moved closer to Russia while squeezing Ukraine. Zelensky told reporters on Sunday about a U.S. deal to exchange hundreds of billions of dollars worth of critical raw materials for strong security guarantees. He said he rejected an early draft because the terms would have left Ukraine heavily in debt. I am not going to sign something that will be paid by 10 generations of Ukrainians, he said. Today, Zelensky welcomed more than a dozen world leaders to Kyiv.
We hope that we can finish this war this year, not in 3 years. It's very, very difficult. Very difficult for all our nation to go through this war.
European leaders arrived by train to music and handshakes. Among them was Ursula von der Leyen, president of the European Commission, who said a just peace for Ukraine can only come through strength.
And this is why we strengthen your economy. This is why we increase the resilience of your energy sector. This is why we will continue training and equipping your troops.
Europeans say this war also affects them, and they want to be at the negotiating table. Finland's president, Alexander Stubb, said the Europeans need to get a plan to the U.S. to make that happen.
Because if you don't have a plan to the Americans, you're not going to get involved in negotiations. And right now, the negotiations are happening above our heads without any kind of a plan and strategy.
He says Europe must get its act together, not only to save Ukraine, but itself. Joanna Kakissis, NPR News, Kyiv.
Life is full of choices, and more, virtual life is too.
And we could give you the gift of our healing touch.
Choices are at the center of the story in Avowed. That's a new video game out this week from Obsidian Entertainment.
Would you help us in return when we ask it?
You have to make the decision, help the mysterious voice, or don't. NPR's Vincent Accavino reports that this kind of storytelling has roots in an older kind of game.
Avowed is a classic fantasy role-playing game. It's got magic, spells, swords, and the role-playing aspect of it is deep. You make your own character and lead them through a plot you are shaping as you play.
I think that's one of the unique things that video games offers, is we can put you in this context, give you this set of choices, and you can really decide what you're going to do about it.
That's Avowed's narrative director, Carrie Patel. She says unlike reading a novel or watching a TV show, you can choose to be the hero or not.
The choice to be good, noble, honorable, etc., doesn't really exist if you're not giving players an actual choice to do something different.
While choice is nothing new for the genre, Avowed is an example of a game that's pushing what it means to play in an open world. But it comes from an old school format.
RPGs of the kind that we make have deep roots in tabletop RPGs.
Tabletop role-playing games like Dungeons & Dragons or D&D specifically. In D&D, players sit in a room with a dungeon master or a story guide, and they make choices together. Everyone describes the fantasy and tells the story as they go.
The reason why the early computer games going forward were a lot of medieval fantasy type stuff is because D&D came out in 1974, And, you know, it was like an explosion.
John Romero is a software designer who was also inspired by D&D. He made the classic shooter game Doom. Romero says the computer games industry really got underway in 1977 as personal computers were becoming more of a thing. And earlier video games used text rather than visuals to tell their stories, but they had the same interactive approach.
Back then, the form was reading and writing. It's like a book. You're reading this amazing novel and you are talking to the novel and it's responding and you're like going places in it.
Romero says in some ways those games were ahead of where we are even now.
You could type entire sentences to this game as if you were talking to somebody and it would take the sentence and analyze it and break it down. It was far more elaborate than anything that you can find today. It was unbelievable.
Years later, stunning graphic worlds, interactive combat, and professional voice acting have fundamentally changed the genre.
Video games are the new storytelling medium of our time.
That's fantasy novelist Brandon Sanderson. We talked about the RPG Mass Effect, which came out in 2007.
How could we just leave her down there?
It was a big hit for a lot of reasons. Good graphics, compelling characters, world building. But the thing that sticks with him and many others about that game is the tough choice he had to make at the end of it.
Lieutenant Alenko, I am your commanding officer. I did what I had to do. Don't question my orders.
You have to save one of two characters that you've been with throughout. The other dies.
You know, this is a gut punch because the game does an excellent job of making you really interested in all these characters, and it presents this final decision as you as a team are all committed in stopping the catastrophe that's coming.
That choice is what many fans of the genre crave most, and that's the challenge that writers and designers and developers are faced with. More options lead to more writing and more code.
Wolves fighting for territory.
Andy Bickerton reviewed the new game Avowed for NPR, and he says that the story takes a while to get interesting, but when it does, it's surprisingly introspective.
One of the main plot threads deals with the themes of trauma and redemption. I was really guessing all the way through the game, all the way up until the end. Like, I think that my choices are leading toward an ultimately, like, good ending, but I had this nagging feeling all the way through that this could end up being really bad.
But a good or bad ending works differently in a game like this.
The story and the choices that you make speak to my own personal philosophy and make me reflect on themes like in my own life.
The best role-playing games, like most art, hold up a mirror. Vincent Accavino, NPR News.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Cunard, offering travelers an opportunity to voyage aboard Cunard's Queen Elizabeth to Alaska. Guests can experience Glacier Bay National Park and Hubbard Glacier, as well as locally sourced cuisine. Learn more at Cunard.com. From EBSCO, committed to upholding the principles of responsible research as they work to develop AI technologies to enhance research around the world. Learn more at EBSCO.com. From Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. And from
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.